Are you creating meaningful change, inspiring hope, and breathing life into the world around you through the stories that you share? Well, today's conversation sets sail from the beautiful island of Mauritius on a very special graduation morning. Our guest, Julie Gishu, challenges us to think deeply about the why behind the stories that we tell ourselves and the communities around us. Julie's an Afro-optimist, a mother, a wife, and currently the Chief Public Affairs and Communications Officer at MasterCard Foundation. In this episode, we delve into her early childhood experiences and the communities that shaped her character, values, and how she sees the world. She speaks on how her passion for theater, plays, and written works birthed her love for storytelling on the African continent and really influenced her approach to journalism in her early years. She steers us through challenging tides of the journalism industry, communication, and storytelling in the digital age, emphasizing the need for creators to ask themselves whether their work is creating a positive impact and supporting the communities that their stories are embedded in. In addition, Julie speaks to the incredible work that she does with MasterCard Foundation and their Young Africa Work strategy, where she's building towards seeing 30 million young Africans in dignified and fulfilling work by 2030. Julie's story inspires every young African to enthusiastically seek out their purpose in all areas of their lives and hold steadfast in answering the calling of our generation. Welcome to the Boardroom Banter podcast. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, wherever it is that you're joining us in from. Thank you for being here and for joining us once again on the Boardroom Banter podcast. My name is Boniface Omina. I'll be your host for today. I'm usually joined by my partner in crime, Sean Karanja, but he's currently not in the country where we're recording this from. But when we began this podcast 2 years, 3 months ago with my two close friends, it was from a conversation that we had in the parking lot on one of those random evenings, you know, when you're done with classes, but you have assignments later. And we were having a conversation about our history together. So amongst the three of us, both of us are beneficiaries of a very amazing mentorship program called Acad Education Group. And at that time, the conversation that we're having is we're looking at the reason why we're in ALU and made it this far is because of the mentorship that we received, both from our adult mentors and from our peer mentors. And a lot of this access to mentorship is one of the things that we saw was missing amongst our people in our communities. Support systems to lean on, safety nets to rely on. And we thought, what's the best way to create access to the conversations that we'd have with our mentors? And so the power that we saw in our hands is the power to connect people and just the value of what mentorship does for a student's journey. And so sitting across from you, given the history that we both share in some aspects, is a testament to just how far we've come in the journey and the power that's there. We have recorded and produced episodes for 82 guests. And there's so much more coming. And looking at this conversation today, we're having it in Mauritius on a very unique day, the 29th of February. It's a day that won't be seen again for the next 4 years. And it's something that I really cherish. And stepping into this conversation, it gives me something to hold on to. And for our listeners, today is an opportunity for you to learn about the incredible story of our guests seated across from me today. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I'd love to introduce you to Madam Julie Gishuru. Julie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I'm so deeply, I'm excited and deeply moved to be seated here with you. Excited for your journey. But also I think it reflects the journey of many other young Africans. And so on this graduation day for ALC here in Mauritius, knowing that young people will change this continent, and many of them will be the ones from this graduating class doing different things. So feels profound. Feels like an important, such an important day.
Beautiful. Thank you, Julie. We're going to kick off the podcast trying to see how our guests view themselves when they look in the mirror and where they're, when they're speaking, introducing themselves to different people. And so if you were to picture a scenario where you were to walk into a if you were to walk into a third grade classroom and explain to 10, 12-year-olds, who is Julie Gishuru? If you were to explain your day-to-day work to them, how would you put it?
Wow, so I don't necessarily define myself by my day-to-day work, and I think that evolves in its own way, but I think I define myself from a core, from the core of my being. So if I was saying to 10-year-olds, who is Julie Gishuru, and to be honest, I try to always communicate for young people to understand, because I think when you communicate in a simple way, it just translates easily. It's authentic, and I think it's powerful. So I would simply say Julie Gishuru is a passionate Afro-optimist. I am an African woman. I'm an African mother of many children. And I'm an African wife who believes in the potential of the continent. And I've had a long career in media, but actually I studied law. And so I think that speaks to the ability for us to really create our own paths. And those paths may not be straight lines, and that's also fine. And I'm just passionate about uplifting the African continent and enabling Africans to thrive and to prosper. I think that's Julie. Yeah.
Beautiful. I'd love to actually pick it up from that note, speaking about your passion for Africa. One thing that we believe on the podcast is that a lot of who we are today and what we do comes from somewhere. Long ago, when we were growing up and everything was happening around us. When I was in third grade, rather I joined third grade in New Jersey after my parents relocated to the US. So dad was working for the United Nations at the time. Mom was doing different businesses, and so she would have to shift her career into a different industry when we got there. And so it was mainly driven by the work that my father was in and the decisions that he was making in his career at the time. And what that did for me is it removed me from Jamhuri Estate in Nairobi to a very small town called Lyndhurst in the north of New Jersey. It removed me from an environment where I was one of 50 other Kenyan students in class to being the only Black child in class. And a lot of these shifts in people and places contributed to, one, my ability to connect with different communities, diverse communities, my ability to integrate, my ability to adapt. And these are some of the skills that came out from these early childhood experiences. And I'd love to understand how this looks like for you, for myself and for the listeners, for anyone meeting you for the first time, for them to understand who you are today and the work that you do. What would they need to know about those early childhood experiences and formative years?
Yeah, wow, that's so incredibly profound. And I think it's good to encourage people look back to look forward, understand who you are and where you came from and what is most dear to you. And you'll actually reconnect with yourself when you look at your childhood experiences, your passions when you were young, etc. So thank you for that question. I think for me, setting the context of my family, so I'm mixed race, I'm Kenyan, but my father's family were from a place called Kashmir, which is between India and Pakistan and still subject to quite a bit of conflict. There was a split that happened and the countries, of course, went through some turmoil. And my father's family ended up in Pakistan and my grandfather put them all on a ship and sent them came to East Africa with them to Kenya. He was a navigator on the ship. And because of the crisis there, made a decision to just relocate his whole family. My father was 1 year old. So my father is Kenyan Asian. My mother is Kikuyu Kenyan. And they fell in love at a time when you didn't often see intermarriage. And between these communities as well. It's an interesting long story, but eventually when my father and mother married, they bought the plot next to my mother's parents. And so I ended up growing up in an extended family setting. So certain things were apparent to me. Number one, we can be from vastly different cultures. My father, a Muslim, Asian, Kenyan man. My mother, an Kikuyu, Catholic woman. And yet live in a home with incredible harmony. So I'm one who believes that there's a lot of similarity between Islam and Christianity. And as people, we can choose to look at similarity or we can choose to focus on differences. And so what we decide is the way, you know, will determine whether people live harmoniously or in conflict, right? So I've always felt that differences should never take away from the value of relationships. They should only add, and harmony is possible. The second thing was, growing up in this extended family, I was very close to my grandparents. And I'm one of those children that, actually my mom says, I was even more close to my grandparents than I was. I was always running to their house. And so that value of learning and observing from a generation away from me, really, I think, embedded in me just a passion for this continent, you know. And I sat at their feet and heard them telling each other stories of the struggle for independence, what they went through. And so just didn't even realize, but all those things were settling in my mind. I was hearing all these things and truly understanding what they went through and sacrificed for us to have the freedoms we have today. You know, the other part of that is, in my teenage years, I made a decision to move from a Catholic school, Catholic girls' school, to a boys, a mixed, so boys were there, girls were there, boarding school, because I felt I was too complacent. You know, I wasn't studying hard enough, and I thought if I'm a class with boys, I don't want to, like, be bottom of the class. So I'll be challenged to perform even better. Yeah. So I was like, I'm too complacent. The nuns like me too much. I'm getting away with so much in Loreto Convent Musangari. I need to move to an environment that challenges me. And I did. And I chose a school called Imani. And my father said, you know, Julie, you have to know, if you choose to go to the school, we'll support you. But in life, make your choices carefully, because, you know, it's your bed that you're making and you will be the one who sleeps on your bed. So, you know, always make careful, considered choices. Yeah. And so I appreciated that they supported that. I went to Imani, where I did perform much better and I thrived. And I was in an environment with a lot of other Africans, which wasn't the case in my earlier school. All of a sudden, a lot of Ugandans, Tanzanians, Zambians, Nigerians, Southern Africans. And I loved that, because all of a sudden, I was learning about perspectives, cultures that I just didn't have a connection to, you know. And that also now almost gave me a 360, you know, around closing the gap now on the African picture, rather than just the Kenyan picture, right? So I think those are some of the things that maybe really influenced and built Julie.
No, definitely. I think the fact that you just mentioned being exposed to information, knowledge, cultures, different African cultures while still in Kenya as a country, just speaks to a similarity in my experience of studying in Delhi over the past 3 years has been exactly that. I wouldn't get to learn about Nigeria and Ghana if I hadn't not just met Whitney, but invested time and conversations into that relationship and cultivating it. Back to that 360 picture of what is going on in your environment in Africa. When I look at the season of life that I'm in now, a lot of my career decisions and personal decisions as well are driven by what I see going on in the world. If we speak about work, for instance, I'm looking at how is artificial intelligence revolutionizing which industry, what is machine learning coming to do, how is the world changing, how did COVID affect all that? And these are some of the current affairs and trends that are influencing my decisions into this season of my life. So if you were to look back at your 20s when you were our age, what is going on in the world that you can remember? What's going on in that bigger picture in Africa, in the world, that you'd see on news, that you hear on radio, that you'd see on newspapers. Your parents would be having conversations about it in the dining room, and you're floating, trying to understand what's going on. If you were to think about some of those trends in current affairs, what would you say were some of the biggest determining factors?
It was a remarkable time.
Yeah.
Remarkable. The world was opening up. And I think what we're seeing now is an age of closure in a, you know, countries are becoming more nationalistic in their thinking and approach. We're seeing conflict at a level that is really concerning, escalating conflict everywhere. We're seeing, you know, we're seeing what I would call a closing up of mindsets. Whereas in my 20s, it was an opening up. And so I'll kick it off from Form 4 at Imani School, which is where I moved, which is in the middle of pineapple plantations of Del Monte in Thika. We ate pineapple every day. The Berlin Wall came down. And so this was the end of the Cold War era. You know, it was a really pivotal moment for those who lived at that time and understood what the Cold War was. You know, seeing Russia letting go of some of those Eastern European states and the bloc coming down, and, you know, the Berlin Wall came down, and we couldn't believe it was happening. And we had a German headmistress, and I remember it was a Sunday, and she said, "Come for tea to my house," to some of her favorite students, "come for tea and we'll watch it happening together." And you know, we were on TV watching it all happening on, I think it was CNN or whatever channel, you know, we had access to at the time. And we talked about what does this mean, and the families that were caught up between Eastern, you know, Germany and Germany, and the coming together. So there was that. And then there was this pivotal moment for Africa, the end of apartheid. That was another really incredible, and I think just earth-shattering moment in the most positive way for the continent, right? So exciting to see, first of all, Mandela released from jail, you know, and then the apartheid system start to crumble, you know, and then Mandela coming into the presidency. And I remember when I was a child asking my mom, why does that happen in South Africa? And she says, it's terrible, it's apartheid, but I don't think we will see it end in our lifetime. Because I was asking, why can't it just end? And then, you know, we are watching it crumbling, and I'm saying the world is moving. And it was so exciting to see. And for some of our countries, in Kenya, it was the beginning of the multi-party era. It was the struggle for a new constitution for the country. It was definitely an opening up. And you could feel it. It was palpable. I was excited. And I thought, this is the way the world should be going. And I want to have a part in building a stronger and a better Africa. The one thing I will say, I'll go back to the fact that, you know, somehow the way we were brought up and conditioned and educated, we believed that you had to get a good colonial system education, get to the top of that as far as you could go to be successful. And now when I look back, I'm disrupting a lot of my own thinking. I'm thinking, it is the disruptors who will be the most successful in this new era. And you, younger generations, do not need to be encumbered by those things that we held so dear. And that's why I'm so excited to be at the graduation of a truly African institution when it comes to education. It's phenomenal, yeah.
Wow. I'm trying to think how whether I'd feel the same way if I was to be there at that time and looking at all of these things happening. I know I can think about a couple of feelings that I'd have. I know I'd be hopeful, I'd be excited, I'd be happy for the places which are having these revolutions, but then also just the world in general, because you can see the world moving from all these historical milestones. I think there'd be a lot of uncertainty and doubt, especially you mentioned that this was happening when you were in Form 4. I can imagine in the Kenyan society, for those listeners who don't know, after Form 4, there's a very, very big conversation you need to have with your parents about what you're going to do I'll take as your undergraduate, as a diploma, wherever you're stepping into. And that uncertainty and doubt is sort of the same thing I'm feeling now, finishing school. My parents were on the campus yesterday. They're saying, all of these African people, all of you are entrepreneurs. There are no doctors here.
No lawyers.
Exactly. And that just goes to the dish that drives you. But that question of what next and looking at the career landscape comes a lot of emotions, comes a lot of expectation from others, expectations on yourself. And you mentioned that you studied law. And I'd love to understand how you got into that. Did you see a place for yourself in the career landscape at the time with everything that was changing around it in the geopolitical space and all that? And how did you navigate that uncertainty and doubt? Were there any specific people that you spoke to or places that you sought out counsel? How was that season? How were those career decisions navigated after that?
That's a great question. Just to contextualize, Berlin Wall, I was in Form 4, Mandela and all that, you know, coming into presidency, I was probably in year two of university or year three of university. So it was a period of time. Yes, in my high school, I thought deeply about what I wanted to do. And my father and I often talked about me studying law, and he kept saying, "You're gonna go become a barrister at Lincoln's in the UK." He actually
that was
had
a plan. That was it.
And I was like, Yes. I had three things I thought I was, you know, possibly gonna be good at and I was passionate about. Number one was theatre. So I really loved theatre. I had started overcoming my stage fright, and by Form 4, I had conditioned myself to use, it hadn't gone, but I would use my stage fright as a tool to make my presentations more authentic and emotional. So I turned my stage fright into an asset. You know, I figured out how to do that. And I loved theater. So I loved reading. I read everything I could. I almost did it. I'm a very fast reader, so I'd do a book a day, you know, thick books, 3 days. I consumed plays. I found old radio scripts for radio play. I would read everything, and I was fascinated with theater. I loved classic theater, and I would have gone and studied Shakespeare and maybe started writing classic theater for Africa if I had the luxury. But I asked a man I really admired. He had set up Phoenix Theater in Kenya. His name was James Falkland. He's passed now many years ago. But he had directed us in some of our plays in high school at Msangari. And I said to him, I really have a passion for theater. Can I go into this as a career? And he said to me, look, Julie, you can, but you need to understand there's no money. So it will be a life of an artist struggling, you know? And I thought about it. I was like, I'm a woman. I want to be able to look after myself. So I want to earn some decent money and look after myself and my family. I was like, okay, that's not going to work. I'll do it as a hobby, right? So I moved that from career to hobby. Then it was journalism and law. And, you know, I was part of the journalism club in high school, etc. I knew I could write. I knew I enjoyed writing. So journalism was an option and law was an option. I looked at them both in Kenya. Journalism was not incredibly prestigious at the time. It was a tough career, right? And law was extremely prestigious. It's one of those things parents asked, where are the doctors and lawyers, you know? And my father had this dream. So I was like, law it is. And so then that's how I made my decision. But I wrote a lot of lists. And I decided, actually, so out of Form 4, I didn't want to do A-levels. I didn't spend 2 years in A-levels. There was that option. I instead went and did a one-year foundation course, and I joined university, right? So that happened, and I studied law in university. After that, I worked for a year to try and save up some money, and my mom, you know, also supported me with some money as well, and I did my master's. My master's was an MBA with a focus on international law and on world trade law and international business. So then I came back to Kenya, and I couldn't find a job. And just to say, when I was deciding even on whether to do a master's, I couldn't afford one, so I had to really make a decision to work hard to get money to pay for one, and to, you know, impress upon my mother to, you know, really, for her, it was a real also commitment and struggle to be able to raise the money to also contribute to my school fees, right? And say to her, I promise this will pay back somehow, you know, I'll make you proud, you know. And so what I did was I wrote a lot of lists again. You know, go get a job, look for a job, da, 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 da. Here's the pros and cons, here's this, here's that. And what I ended up with is, you know, I'm a young woman and there's a lot of perception society has. And I felt like education was my armor because otherwise I walk into a room and people assume things and they want to put me in certain boxes. The more education I have is going to be critical. But also I wasn't just paying for the degree, the paper. I wanted the knowledge. I wanted to walk into rooms and have the knowledge to think through things, position myself, do the work I would need to do. So I decided to do that MBA. And so how I was very anxious, very anxious. I found out many years later what I went through in university was depression. My parents divorced while I was at university and I had come from a very, very close family. So that pulled the rug from my feet. I felt I had no ground to stand on and nowhere to go home. You know, I had no home because a new wife for my father had come and they were living in the house and my mom emigrated to the US. Now I didn't have a room. I didn't have a home. I had nowhere to go. So I had to figure out where's you have to build, right? So I used a lot of lists. I went through a lot of insomnia, etc. But I got through it. And when I was going through it, I kept saying to myself, Julie, plow on, you know, just plow on. And I identified the things that I couldn't drop that I needed to do. And I passed all my exams by the grace of God and through friends who would bring me the notes when I couldn't get out of bed. And they knew I didn't want to be disturbed. And they just put notes under my door in university. That's it. And just me getting those notes and studying was so pivotal to helping me stay on track and pass my exam. So I'm so thankful to that, those friends.
I'm quite fascinated to understand how you arrived at that realization that what you were going through at the time was depression. Could you talk to me about some of the steps that you took towards reflecting on that season of your life and discovering, oh, this is what I was going through? I think it's important because those are some of the tools that in our day and age we look for on social media, we look for in the mental health guides, we look for in the professionals, but then we also look for in the people closest to us. What did those steps look like?
Yeah, so let me talk about what I was doing at the time. And then I'll speak about what made me realize what I was going through, which was much later. I couldn't sleep. I had terrible insomnia, terrible. So debilitating that, you know, I would blink and it would feel like there was sandpaper in my eyes. It was crazy. And at the same time, I was so lethargic. I couldn't get out of my room or out of bed for days at a time. So that was just so bizarre in and of itself. I would go into periods of just, you know, being on my own and just not coming out. And honestly, my roommates would cook food for me and bring it to my door. And at one point, I lost so much weight. I think I was in 40 kg mark, like, you know, somebody who typically would have been about 55, right? 46, 45 kgs, right? So a lot of weight loss and just lackluster, no energy. What I admire about who I was then is I stayed praying to God and sometimes would argue with him, right, in my room but I would pray and I'd say, never let me go. You know, I know I'm upset now or we're going through this period, but just hold me tight and never let me go. And so my faith and my belief in God was just, it was there. It was standing. I had great friends and I'm so thankful to them. So like I said, bringing me notes and at some point, not even judging me, some point trying to force me, we're going for a jog today. And I'm like, no, we're not. And they're like, yes, we are. And forcing me to go on a jog, you know, and which just gets me out into fresh air and moving. And sometimes just feeding me. Have you eaten? Here, I've cooked for both of us, you know, that kind of thing. So those are the small things that could be so pivotal because sometimes even in that period, I had to go through it, you know, to keep coming out of it and be forced into would also have really been destabilizing for me, because obviously I needed the rest. So having room, but at the same time being brought in some crucial things that kept me moving from my friends was so important. What made me realize later that I was in depression, I was reading the signs of depression, everything, sleeplessness, lethargy, you know, all those things. I was like, oh my goodness, I was actually in the throes of depression. And yes, it was because my family had literally fractured. You know, I was angry with my dad for moving on from us. And, you know, how could you? I didn't even feel anxiety for myself as much as I felt for my younger brothers. I was like, I had a solid childhood till my late teens. So I was thinking for my younger brothers, oh my gosh, if this is destabilizing for me, what does it mean for them, right? So all those things, and my worry for my mom, you know, she's now decided to emigrate because of all of this. Is she going to be okay, you know? And who stands by her? So, you know, I had all that, and I couldn't even speak that much with, you know, external, you know, my friends knew, but I didn't want to, you know, so I had to carry it. And so I think just checking in with each other and then asking ourselves, what does my friend need the most right now? You know, or feeling free if you're the one going through it to say to your friends, I can't do this and this, but can you help me with that would be really pivotal. So I think that's important, because even spaces was important for me. I needed some of my space, but I needed help as well. So how do you balance that, you know? So yeah,
I like the phrase that you use of you had to carry it. And if you look at the Bible, at the story when Jesus was being escorted is a very interesting word to use. To be crucified, you know, there are a lot of verses that speak about picking up your cross and carrying it. But then in that story, we also see that someone helped him carry
it. And he was an Ethiopian.
Wow.
Yeah, I take such pride that an African helped him carry the cross. I'm going to cry. I'm going to start tearing in a minute.
Feel free to take time over the course of podcast. I was holding back emotion a couple of minutes ago as well. But back to what I had mentioned about how my friends and I found each other. The reason why I love ACAD so much and we love ACAD so much compared to other mentorship programs is that they really focus on peer mentorship. I think one thing that ACAD understands is that there's a distance that's there, whether subconsciously or whatever, between young people and older people, you know, where we can reach out to them for guidance, but we can't always confide in them. But when you foster peer relationships, you can have the best of both worlds. You can have the best of both worlds. And the best of that is it's a value-added relationship. And so there's value in the context of what a mentor would provide. Counsel, guidance. We're in different industries, so there's that cross-pollination that's happening. But then also, there's the days when the phone call is not about work, but it's about what's going on at home. It's not about work, but it's about how you're feeling about the relationship that you're in that just ended. You know, the number of times I've cried to my friends about... Anyway, that's another story.
It's valid, yeah. and it's
And so that's something that really struck me when you mentioned you having to carry that for your family. I'm the last born of five, and so I haven't had to carry some of the things that my siblings carried in the family, for instance, because my parents were in a different place by the time I was getting to an age where I'm beginning to understand and question and ask certain questions. And I realized that there is a privilege that comes with having older siblings. And I reckon that may be what your siblings felt, you know, from seeing you carrying that for them and guiding them through that. So
Thank you. Thank you very much for sharing that.
All right, guys, let's go.
Emotions. Emotions. Yeah.
Thank you, Julie. I want us to spend a couple of minutes speaking about journalism. Early on, you mentioned that it was a tough career to get into at the time. And I'd love to understand the infrastructure in the industry and some of the workplace culture that was there. And more so towards further understanding how that has really changed coming into 2024, into the century that we're in, with the rise of digital platforms such as social media, online news sources. How have these changes impacted the journalism industry from what you've seen, and the larger conversation of how storytelling and narratives are packaged?
Yeah, so it's so interesting. It's evolved so significantly. So when I went into the newsroom the first time, I had made a decision. I never liked sitting down doing nothing. So out of high school, I remember I heard that the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, was taking young interns to do some clerical type work. And I must have been 17, 18. I just went and asked, can I get a job here? And they were like, no, we've got enough clerks. And I was like, okay. But I went every morning. Every morning I get in the car with my mom and dad, and we drive there, and I'd sit at reception saying, just in case, like, you get one more position, I'm just here, right? And I'd go and sit there all day till they had to. Like, they kept, like, we don't have anything. Like, you don't have to come every day. And the next morning, on time, I'd be seated there at reception. So they gave me a job, and I did this incredible work around. I had no idea how important it would be. We were tracking the lost boys with Sudan. That's what they ended up called later. There was conflict in South Sudan, and the boys had to trek. Boys from as young as 3 years old all the way up to late teens had to trek from their villages to a certain point for the UN system to receive them, because the UN system couldn't go in. And we had people at certain points just tracking how many boys made it to the next point and to the next point. And so we had their photos and who made it, and, you know, trying to see. So that's the work we did. And again, just, you know, what that did for me to say that we cannot do this to our people on this continent. It is unacceptable. Our children should not be going through these things. You know, talk less of what happened to the girls. You know, we've never said what happened to the girls when the boys were trekking. The boys made it. Some of them, many of them came into Kenya, and some of them went as far as the US and are doing great things in the world. What happened to the girls? But that's a separate issue. And so I did that. And so I always believed in keeping busy, right? So when I finished my degree, I came back for internship. I did an internship at a law firm in Kenya, Hamilton, Harrison and Matthews. And then I went to a media house as well. And I said, you know, can I do something, anything? I'd be willing to do anything. And they took me in for an internship as well. And so it was interesting. It was KTN. It was the new kid on the block. So prior to that, we only had what was Voice of Kenya and then Kenya Broadcasting Corporation. So the national public broadcaster. So it's the first private media television station. And I did whatever reporting was necessary at that time. And you were kind of on your own. So a young person from university, you've walked in, everyone gives you funny faces. You kind of have to figure out, try to smile at people and ask questions and see who might be an ally, and just figure out, okay, look at the diary, whatever anybody doesn't want to cover, I'll do it. Yeah. You know what I mean? So that's kind of, I spent, I think, a month there. And then I had made that decision at that point to go back and do my master's. So I went back. And then when I came back later, after my master's, it was meant to be just to support my mom for a few months. And then I was going to do what my dad and I always talked about, which was to do the bar at Lincoln's Inn and become a barrister, right? So I was now trying to save money for that. So I just looked for a job just for the short time that I was going to be here, and then I wanted to leave. So I went back to KTN, and they took me in, and this time they said, can you focus on legal and business reporting? And this time it wasn't necessarily an internship. It was more of, we're putting you on the news desk, and it's because we really need legal and broadcasting and business, you know, specialist skills for those desks, right? So I came in, but they told me, but we can't pay you anything. So you've just got to figure out how to, you know, just work for free until we think you're valued enough to get a salary. And I said, fine. But remember, my family had fractured. My dad had a new family and I was upset with him. So I wasn't living in his house or asking him for money. My mom had moved to the US and she was trying to stand herself and my younger brothers up there. So I didn't want to impose on her. I was living with my grandmother in Nairobi in a place called Dagoretti, which is where we had grown up because they were still there. Yeah. So, and maybe that also for me was a bit healing because I felt like now I was, you know, and my grandmother and I am named after her. She was Julia Gadoni and I'm Julie Gadoni. So we were close. So I was there and it was hard. So you just had to figure out how to build allyship. Nobody was willing to train you. It's almost like in the newsroom there, I want to be very candid, everybody was competition. Because everybody wanted to be the top story. You come in here, you've got a very good education, you look well put together, you're competition. So you better figure out how to sink or swim. So I just embodied as much grace as I could. I was as friendly as possible with everybody and I just tried to figure it out. And then I met my husband, you know, and I fell in love. And so the whole bar, Lincoln's Inn stuff was like, finished. I'm staying in Kenya. Yeah. So I'm so thankful to him that he kept me on the continent and he changed my life trajectory. And then somehow I did build a great career in media because I decided, okay, I'm gonna do this and I'm gonna do it well. There was another assumption that if you went to university and if you went to university abroad, you were a, you know, delicate type, Barbie type thing. So you couldn't, and I was like, is it there now? Yeah. So I was like, I'm going to work twice as hard. I'm going to do this. And I did. I worked as hard as I could. So that's where my media career took off. And it was 20 years down the line when I stepped into a different space. And just to say very quickly, I now work for the MasterCard Foundation, an incredible foundation that has done remarkable things, and particularly for the African continent. We were set up by MasterCard, but we are not MasterCard because they had the grace and the incredible vision to set up a truly independent foundation that's not controlled by them. They put 10% of their shares aside and said, we're creating this and it's going to do great things for the world. And so our work has been primarily in Africa. And also, because we are registered in Canada as a charity, we do work with Indigenous communities in Canada, and primarily around education and financial inclusion. Our mission is really, or our strategy for Africa is Young Africa Works, to see 30 million young Africans in dignified and fulfilling work by 2030. And we partner with, of course, the Africa Leadership Group, which includes ALC, ALU, and ALA to educate you amazing young Africans. Yes, yes. And we're so honored and we know you're going to change the world.
Sweet. I'm going to put a pin on Young Africa. Young?
Young Africa Works.
Young Africa Works. I'm going to put a pin on that. I'll come back to MasterCard a bit later.
MasterCard Foundation.
MasterCard Foundation. Yes, guys. MasterCard Foundation is different from MasterCard. You spoke about the professional relationships. We began doing this thing with our community, right? After we ran the podcast for 2 years, we said, okay, we have thousands of listeners from around the world, but we don't have visibility of who these people are. So let's see how many of them we can recruit into a community and then now invest a lot more of our plans in the community. Plans for one-on-one mentorship, plans for webinars and a bit more engagement and that connection. And so we started doing bi-weekly community campfires where we just hop on a call every two Sundays, and for 1 hour, 30 minutes, we just connect, and after that, call it a day. So the previous one, we invited Dr. Reche to speak about how to navigate professional breakups. And that is situations where either it's a mentor-mentee relationship that isn't working out anymore, how do you navigate yourself out of that? Or it's a work-to-work relationship and you have to figure out how to navigate conflict in that specific context. It's just hearing you speak about that competitive climate in journalism, and getting a good story just reminded me of that. A good story. When I was in primary school, I did a book called Kiswahili Mufti. And there were these stories that we'd run through every single day, and they'd use that to teach us how to tailor a composition and an insha. And I guess you can look 5-10 years ahead of that and think about, oh, that's probably how Omina is structuring a podcast script or a script for a movie or in theater, and how to write a good story. If you were to define what makes up a good story, what components would you say go into that, even outside the context of journalism? For one, to be able to convey and communicate a message about a people, a person, place, or time period, what are some of the components that you say go into a good story?
So for me, I think I always think about it from a perspective of what's my objective? What am I communicating? You know, I get incredibly disturbed by books or movies where you're left at the end hanging and there's no kind of learning, message, lesson. And I ask myself, why did I just spend my time on this? Like, what am I supposed to take for this? And then my brain starts trying to pull, you know, the lesson. And if I can't pull any lessons, it's extremely frustrating for me. So just the way my mind, and I'm a bit OCD, so maybe it's good for me to say that, because a creative mind might want to tell a story with no objective, which is fine. But for someone with OCD, you're probably looking at tying neatly up the end. So I start with, what am I seeking to do? And I'm a message carrier. I tend to be a message carrier. So I then identify my message, and my message is tied to the societal impact I'm hoping to achieve. So I'll never tell a story, as dramatic as it may be, as many eyeballs as it may get, because it may be sensational, I'll never tell a story that I think does harm or could do harm or that could fracture communities. So going back to my childhood and harmony, I'll always tell stories that build harmony and cohesion. That's just how I am, because I know the power of disharmony. It is dangerous. So we can touch on tough issues, but it will always end with inspiring people to positive action. So that's just my storytelling. Maybe for each person, it's to ask, what's my signature for storytelling? What's my unique style? What am I seeking to do and why, right? So then I look at, what's the beginning? Where does it start? And the beginning is where you hook everybody. And in the first few minutes, they decide, am I staying or am I going? So the beginning is critical. And then the end is what you leave them with. And you always want to leave them feeling, even if it's been emotional, even if it's been hard, you want to leave them feeling hope and inspired and feeling almost a personal call to be part of this, to see a space for themselves, right? So this is how I see storytelling for me. And so everything in between, there's a number of things: strong, good characters, authentic connection, emotive. I always seek to, like, a lot of times when I did stories later in my career, if I didn't make you cry or feel like crying, I didn't feel I was quite done. Like if I was doing a proper story or even doing an interview, or if I didn't make you feel rallied, you know, called to action, I didn't feel I was quite done. So there's that emotional tug. And this is really interesting, because I think I'm going into a phase where I'm going to do much more storytelling and actually also fictional writing and possibly movie making. And ooh, so,
Julie.
Yeah.
We are ready. We're ready.
I'm seeing the screenplays. I have the characters. They live in my head. It's like they're friends of mine and they're saying, give me life, you know? And so, and the way they are framed to inspire people. They're very embedded in culture, but they're sharp and they're fast and they're smart, and in their own small ways at different levels are changing the world. So others can see that and say, whoa, we can do that, you know? So I think for me, beginning and end, knowing your objectives, knowing your unique signature style, and then authentic connection. Those, I think, are so, so important.
I love the intentionality behind your storytelling, the focus on impact. And it looks like it feels like you're reflecting the world that you see around you, that you interact with, and just translating that, packaging that for people, and packaging that narratives. And I think when I look at the platforms available now for storytelling and for gifting your stories to people, it goes back to what you said of identifying what your style is. I don't know how well I'd do as a YouTube vlogger, right? Just because I understand my style and how I come across.
And you're excellent at what you do.
Thank you.
Yes, excellent.
And because podcasting as an industry has shown up out of nowhere and is evolving into what it is, and I have the ability to package this episode and put it out into the world, right? And so this change in technology, I think, has given everyone a lot of power. And I'd love to understand whether you feel like, as a generation, we have a greater responsibility to tell more authentic stories and be more authentic and intentional with our storytelling, because you mentioned that it can be dangerous, you know, the same power. How do you feel like we should navigate this as people who want to launch platforms and spread our message and tell narratives and put narratives out there? What should we make sure we do right, and what should we just steer away from in terms of being authentic?
That's great. First of all, you know, you've tapped into the fact that it's a new world and you can self-broadcast. And I do believe that we're going to continue to see the evolution or even revolution, and many of the mainstream media platforms that can't evolve, as big as they are going to crumble. Like Goliath, they're going to come down. And David, this is the world of David, right? It's the world of you guys who know what you do, who do it so well, and the world of self-broadcasting. You know, a lot of people who come to me and say, oh, can I get into this? Can I get into that? And I'm like, actually, media houses they're constricting. They're, you know, they're getting smaller. They're letting go of staff there. But also, because it's happening because audiences have gone. If you're in a room with your peers and you ask them how many of them are watching mainstream news, is it even 2 out of 100? Maybe 3? Yeah, I tend to ask when I go to young people, I tend to ask that question. And it's part of my decision making when I moved out of media. And at that time, many years ago, it was 3 to 5 in a group of 100 who were watching mainstream news. At that point, an industry is collapsing. And it's alarming that... And there were voices in the industry like mine that kept saying, evolve or die. And people would laugh. Oh, Julia, so dramatic. I'm like, no, I'm serious. Evolve or die, you know?
And now they're seeing that happen.
Now we see that. And the journalists that... So many of them that have moved into online spaces and are just doing their own things and are thriving because they have their audiences. To answer your question, I will simplify it and say there's so many different ways to do things, and everybody needs the room to do what they do. We need comedy, right? We need to laugh. And sometimes comedy is healing. Sometimes comedy is an incredible enabler of change. You know, so you can use that. You know, some people want to do arty stuff and some people want to do, and there's room for everybody. Do they call it the long tail, where, you know, the bottom of the tail, you may still have 100 viewers who love this and will watch it all the time. And then maybe at the top of the tail, you have people who have millions, but you live in a world now where the long tail can exist because there's a space for everybody. I wonder if in this space of journalism, the one thing we need to hold dear is do no harm. It's just do no harm. Ask yourself, you know, what does my messaging and what I'm doing contribute to the world? And if in any way it's building conflict, causing more problems, victimizing, creating people who end up being attacked or targeted or things like that, you know, then we need to rethink what we're doing and ask why, and et cetera, et cetera. So I almost feel like doctors that, media needs this kind of principle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The care, the kind of care, and yeah, I like that. Let's head back to your work with MasterCard Foundation. I'd love for us to paint a picture for our audience of how your work looks like on the continent. Because one thing that I'm hearing is that communication is different, audiences are different, and therefore strategies are different. What are some of the regional nuances that we can see when it comes to communication across different parts of the continent? And how does that look like for you in terms of working with young people and accessing young people, first of all, getting their attention? In this TikTok generation, you know, people are very short attention spans.
Yeah.
And so where do you go to reach for your people, and how do you tailor these different strategies in unique ways according to which part of the continent that you're
right. working? So maybe let me start with a more overall picture, and it'll also touch on our work in Canada. I mean, the work we do in the world is primarily in Africa, but I did mention that we are regulated in Canada, and therefore we work with Indigenous communities in Canada to enable what they describe as meaningful work. And it's so important that we remain rooted in communities. And so we seek to understand where they are, what they need, and we seek to hear their voices, and especially voices of young people who we serve, right? I see us as serving communities and young people. And so the foundation started off with an approach that really didn't require us to be seen. So we were doing incredible work and our partners were at the front, you know. So our brand was not necessarily actively storytelling or, you know, but as we grew, and we've grown phenomenally, we are now maybe one of the top three foundations in the world. That's how big we've become by virtue of MasterCard shares increasing exponentially in value. It's made us who we are today and enabled so much more work and impact. And so as this journey continued, we realized visibility was important, right? We had to change our approach. And the reason why was transparency. This is who we are. This is what we do. This is the work we do. These are our partners. So people can know and also hold us to account, but be aware, etc. But also realizing that now as we've grown, people are asking us to share our learnings. You know, we have been given so much grace by all the different stakeholders and have been welcomed into rooms as a trusted convener. So governments, partners in the private sector, other development partners, communities saying, we trust you. You know, and so bring us together, because sometimes government and private sector may not be that comfortable together, or the development world doesn't understand the private sector. But all of them are saying to us, be an actor that convenes us. And so realizing that role as a trusted actor and as a convener means that we can shift practices and policy. So beyond what we fund in terms of partnerships, we can enable learning, we can enable sharing, we can connect actors. So there's so much other transformation that can happen just by taking that role. So more than just communicating, I always say, you know, when teams come in, we don't sell Coca-Cola. You know, selling Coca-Cola is, you know, going out there, communicating, build a brand, da-da-da-da, people buy the Coca-Cola. For us, it's so different. It's far more complex. So we have a lot of partnerships. If we were announcing partnerships every day, all people would be hearing is another partnership, that value, another part. Well, where's the work? So we tell partners who are so keen to announce partnerships, please don't, or let's do it quietly. What you need to be proud of announcing is the impact. So focus on the impact, right? And when we have impact, let's go to the media and go to the world and say, this many young people trained, X number in dignified and fulfilling work, more work to do here, learnings here, etc., right? And so that comes with a lot of complexity. So we've been trying to build at local level, understanding with our partners, understanding with the ecosystems that we're in. We're doing a lot of convening and bringing together different voices for learning. And I think we're going to do much more of that. And so let me touch on our work in Canada with Indigenous communities. If any of you have done the reading or visited Canada, you will know that while it's a first world nation, the marginalization of Indigenous communities is, it's heartbreaking, it's shocking, it's even difficult for us as, you know, we've been through a lot as Africa. They've been through an awful lot as well. And in some ways, you know, it continues in the US and in Canada. And there are so many things that Africans and Indigenous communities across the world can learn and share together, and I think we need to. But the thing that is so important was when we sat down to partner with them, we started saying to them, oh, we have X number of scholarships for you guys to go to university and get meaningful education. They said, no, that's not meaningful for us. And by the way, our communities were forced into education systems decades ago, and we are digging mass graves from those missionary schools. So we do not believe in that education. That education has brutalized us. It has killed us. It has traumatized us. And our children are not going. Our children are staying in the communities. That was number one. Number two, they said, our learning and what we value culturally is our way of life on our land. We believe in preserving the land. We believe in looking after the heritage. Every time you open a meeting with Indigenous communities, they honor the land. They say thank you to the land for housing us and looking after us. What a thought, right? So they said to us, the learning that we value is not in any of those. And you know, and then we realized we can't even try to create it in those schools. So we said, okay, let's create learning here. And you tell us what's learning. And so we have a program with a university in the Yukon where a grandmother could say, I have crocheting, cultural crocheting skills. And my granddaughter has chosen to go into this as a career. So our courses that I'm going to teach my granddaughter over the next 1 year, how to crochet culturally. And then a value is put on that. And that is a course. So the grandmother earns something from teaching her granddaughter, and the granddaughter gets to have some kind of stipend to live through, you know, and gets her education, and then it gets a certificate. But can you imagine? So simple. But is there a value to weaving, cultural weaving, even here in Africa, or crocheting, or making the fabrics that our communities make? And which universities are doing that? Or why can't we enable at community level communities to pass the knowledge and formalize that and issue certificates for that? So there's some incredible stuff happening there. And so even from how we communicate, it means we need to listen to them, understand them, and then also target our communicating to what is relevant for where they are going, not what's good for our PR. So it's about them, and it's about the work, and it's about the impact, right? So we're really on this journey. I mean, I came in from the media, and I had all these, like, we're going to do this, and then I'm told, well, hold on a minute. First learn, listen and learn. And I've gone through almost a masterclass over the past 4 years in embedding yourself, putting yourself at the hands of communities and others and saying, what do you want? And then from a communications perspective, what aids you to get there? So rethinking everything we know and starting from scratch to build something. I think that's kind of where we are and where we are trying to take our partners. So we're probably now enabling our partners to better understand that. Look to the communities. Look to the young people. It's not all about, you know, you and your objectives, but it's got to be rooted in them. So very, very interesting. And I have not answered your question, but I hope I've set more context.
No, but I can see where you're coming from in terms of one, human-centered design and how iterative that process is. You need to always go back and ask questions because you could be focusing on the wrong solution, right? And so in many ways, you have answered the question. Thank you.
Thank you, Prof.
You're welcome. It's funny, the next question was going to be, what are some interesting things you've learned about people and culture, and whether the lens through which you view society has changed through the years? And so there's an aspect of that that you've touched on. But furthermore, I love to hear how it's changed in terms of your career, right? From this passion for theater, but not being able to do it, rather deciding against it, to law, to media? Do you feel like the work that you've done has allowed you to take off a pair of glasses, put on another one? And what lesson is there in that of stepping into, exposing yourself to as many spaces as possible, not just culturally or socially, but also in terms of work, as we speak to a time and season where as students were being asked, okay, so what's the first one? You know, is there a second one? You know, are you not going to step into that? Are you going to go into academia? What's the value in that kind of exposure?
So it's so interesting. The first thing I'll say, I'll step backwards first and say, in order to go on this journey, you have to know who you are. You have to know who you are. Otherwise, the winds will sweep you everywhere. And so I went on, you know, this discovery of how to learn who we are, which is to go backwards to your childhood. And this is where we started our discussion today. And I love that. And to ask people who knew you when you were young, you know, what was I like? What did I love? What did I love? And listen to them. Because the world spends years disconnecting us from our passion. And a lot of people when I was young told me I couldn't stop telling stories. And I had the wildest imagination. Wildest, but I also would listen a lot and comment a lot, you know. And I was like, yeah, that's who I am. And you may go back, or someone may go back and learn that they loved to sing and they loved music, and somehow music inspired them. But everybody said, you can't do this, you can't do this. Or you loved art, and everybody said, you can't do this. But to stop doing that disconnects you from an innate part of what gift was put in you to give to the world. And so go back and find out, who are you? And then ask those things about me then and today, who I am, what you know, what does all that mean? And just find yourself, right? So first of all, go on a journey of finding yourself. Then the second thing is, in every season, everywhere you are, listen. Listening is so powerful. As much as possible, hear and learn. And I, you know, one thing I love is I am a lifelong learner. I'm always learning. I'm learning from everybody. You know, and that's such a valuable thing. In my career, at every point, listening has been pivotal. And I probably was that girl who was like always debating, arguing in school. The one thing I started to learn in high school, into university and out of university is, stop it. Keep quiet. You've already got a very loud voice and you know how to use it. Keep quiet and listen. And then when you use it, it's much better informed. Stop being judgmental, you know? Open yourself up to seeing what other shoes feel like, because that's really where the power is. And not everybody's in your shoes, and that's okay. That's important, because the value, remember, in differences is that they build richness and they can build harmony. So I kept learning that. And maybe one of the most pivotal things was in the post-election violence of Kenya. You know, when Kenya exploded. And I felt very guilty as media that had really told Kenyans, go and vote, your vote is important. We were rallying people to vote, which is an important exercise, self-determination. But I kept asking myself, did we make people feel that their right to vote was more important than their neighbor's right to vote? Did we make them feel that people should follow one direction? Like, where did we get that wrong? Like, what happened, yeah? That you could question your neighbor and hurt your neighbor over their choice, you know? So I immediately sprung into peace, peace, peace. And I started doing everything I could from a comms-wise, and every time I went on air, to make people cry and feel like peace, 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 right? And I wanted to touch the heart of the nation and stop and stay in your home, stay safe, do not hurt your neighbors. Everybody has a right to choose. And if anything has gone wrong, it's not your neighbor's fault. There are others that need to, you know. So it was all of that. And coming out of that, the period of understanding that these communities have to live together again. And yet so much has happened. And we went through a period of a show called Fist to Five. Fist to Five is a technique for mediating communities. It was used in Rwanda after the genocide, where if you start have a conversation, vastly different communities, you can imagine the tension after a period like post-election violence. And then you bring an issue to the floor and you say, if you agree,
5. Put 5 fingers up. If you disagree strongly, fist. If you're in the middle, 3. You understand? So you get to understand in a room very quickly what people agree with and what people disagree with. And you get to see the extreme voices, and then you can ask them, why do you disagree strongly? And then you have a conversation as the whole group. And by the time you finish a series of conversations, you know, we would start with people literally tense, angry, because we were going into communities where violence happened. At the end of the journey, people were hugging and crying together. And then I would never say it. I would never be the one to say it. Inevitably, somebody in the audience would say, can we hold hands and pray together at the end? And then you've brought communities that were warring together just through conversation and understanding and the willingness to each of them commit when we go in to be willing to understand the shoes of the other. So I may not agree with you. I may disagree very strong. I'm at a 5, yeah, of disagreement. I'm at a fist, right? But I'm going to pretend I'm you when you're talking. So I'm going to try to understand. Instead of standing in my fist, I'm going to try to understand where you're coming from. And that's such a powerful tool. So that really, really reshaped me and gave me the ability to say, just continue understanding. Just continue listening and understanding. So, yeah, in every season, just try to find ways to, what are the learnings? And how do I evolve to be more effective for everybody else through the learnings?
Oh, that is powerful, Julie. And I'm presenting a lot of lessons, not just because of the season that I'm in, but because of the work that I'm in. And understanding just the power of narratives and storytelling. As we come to the end of this very beautiful conversation, Julie, and looking ahead at your future, what excites you about your future? What is it that the world can look to you and hope to see in the coming future?
Thank you. So I it's a great question, and actually I am exiting the foundation in this year, and it's been close to four and a half years of just the most incredible journey of learning, working with the most incredible people. Our president and CEO, Rita Roy, who had this vision so early at the start of the foundation of education being critical, and look what it has birthed, right? And I know a lot of people will track their success, and Africa and the world will track a shift just driven by that decision. And just honored to have walked this journey with this incredible organization. And seeing myself moving forward into a phase of going back deeper into the continent, much deeper, and connecting with young people, but also feeling a responsibility to connect young people to our history and our culture, and to help them ask, where have we come from? And therefore, when I look forward, where are we going? I can build it so much more clearly, because I know my ancestors. And I feel like Africa has, you know, this studies and talk about trauma DNA. But we do have trauma DNA because we've been so brutalized in so many ways, you know, from pre-colonialism to colonialism to, you know, where we are today, which was accepting, actually disconnecting us from some of our cultural, you know, into accepting the norms of the modern world without carrying both with pride, in its own way is brutalizing us. Because in some way it's communicating that you and your communities are not good enough. So you need to mock or mimic other things. And so, you know, there are so many layers of that, but going back to understand, and especially from the generation that died for us to be free, why did you do that? What was your vision? And we may not be in exactly the same place, or you might be surprised that everything they said resonates. But who's going to connect these generations? I want to do that. I want to connect with young Africans and do more storytelling. And I want to. So there's so many things. So I'm so excited. I see it, and it's so big, and it's training, it's enabling, it's helping you guys tell your stories, and it's so much. It's helping the elderly document their stories before they leave us to go into the next. next realm, because they are passing. And if they go and we don't document this, we're going to be so much poorer for it, you know, intellectually and emotionally and culturally. So I see a season for me there. And I'm so aware that my time here is finite. So I feel it's pressing that, Julie, you need to contribute something there. Yes, before I go. So, yeah. Yeah, that's it.
That sounds so exciting. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you for allowing us to not just step into your shoes, but walk in those shoes and step into your world and see what your world has been like over the years. To our listeners, we hope that the time spent with us on the podcast has been fulfilling. If you need to re-listen to this episode, please do. See what aspects of Julie's story resonate with you. Take what you can take and gift to someone else as well, and recommend Julie's stories to others. Julie, as someone who's stepping from one person to the other, stepping into these new seasons of our lives, I want you to let you know that we got it. We're going to be okay. Thank you. Thank you to our listeners, and we'll catch you on the next episode. Take care, guys.
Hey there, folks. We're wrapping up today's episode with a quick one from our sponsors, Nepal Tea Collective. Nepal Tea is a social enterprise based in New York that distributes the freshest organically grown teas to different parts of the world, directly sourced from smallholder farmers in the beautiful country of, you guessed it, Nepal. We're proud to be sponsored by them, and at the end of our episodes, we like to wind down, and we cannot think of a better way to wind down than with a cup of hot Nepal tea. So if you'd like to check them out, go and look them up at nepalteacollective.com. That's nepalteacollective.com for more information. See you on the next one, guys.